Moo. Dream it. Print it.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. On the first half of today's program, we're going to continue with our interviews with the Tampa mayoral candidates. Today, Mike Suarez. He's a Tampa native and a USF graduate. He's been on Tampa City Council since 2011. His District 1 seat includes the entire city, and he is term limited from running again. Suarez is an insurance agent. He's an insurance professional by trade. He's also a former aide to U.S. Senator Bob Graham. And Mike Suarez, welcome to WMNF. Good to see you.
Hey, listen, it's a pleasure being here. I'm on your PBS show. I haven't been there in a while, like last time I talked to you, but it's always fun to talk to you. You are the best professional in this particular...
Oh, now come on. You're just trying to butter me up before
this
tough interview.
Absolutely, I'm trying to butter you up, Rob. This is what this is all about. So,
Mike, why do you want to be mayor of Tampa?
Well, listen, we have done a lot of great things over the last 7.5 years. The mayor and council together have actually put together a pretty good development portfolio. But one of the things that we have not done is remember the neighborhoods. One of the reasons I'm running is to make sure that we get back to our roots, so to speak. And that's why I have a neighborhood bill of rights that talks about four tenants. You know, we have a need for improved service, public safety, and that means making sure that our police officers are trained and more in community policing, getting out there, getting to do certain things. Need to make sure that our firefighters get the equipment they need and the vehicles they need. The third thing is improved transportation. We'd offer transportation passing. We have a great opportunity to not only change the scope of our larger transportation, but our simple ones like sidewalks. And that's why we're going to have a sidewalk selection survey to all the neighborhoods across the city. And then the fourth thing is integrity in governing. And what I mean by that is say what you're going to do and do it. If you can't do it, make sure you're as honest and straightforward with people as possible to say, we can't do it, and give the reasons why. Our job as a government and my job as the next mayor of Tampa is to communicate to people what we can do, what we're going to do, and try and stick to the commitments that we make.
I've read that you say that you're going to be out in the neighborhoods. You're not going to be just bunkered down at City Hall or the city government building, that you're going to be out there a lot. Do you think that the current mayor has neglected the neighborhoods?
I will put it to you this way. I have visited all the certified neighborhoods in the city of Tampa. There's over 70 of them. And I've been to all these different events, whether they're special events, you know, and festivals, you know, crime watch meetings, regular association meetings. And the mayor, when he first got elected, used to have quarterly meetings with in the neighborhoods. That stopped probably within his first 2 years. Now, that's up to him to decide as to what he's doing and not doing. For me, I just want to continue what I've been doing as a city council member. But in addition, we've made a commitment that we will be doing these neighborhood meetings every quarter and making sure that if we do something on a quarter, we're going to have 10 different neighborhoods involved there. We'll have senior staff there to talk about issues in each one of those neighborhoods, all, you know, that are connected to each other. So if we're in the South Tampa area, we might have Hyde Park or Virginia Park or Ballast Point or so on. And then if we're in East Tampa, College Hill and Rainbow Heights and Jackson Heights and Belmont Heights, all those places that make up East Tampa.
When you talk about sidewalks, we can go to Tampa Heights. We can go to south of Gandy. Mm-hmm. We can go all over West Tampa. There's some neighborhoods that have been there forever in West Tampa near the stadium
where my mother lives.
Exactly. And yeah, and that don't have sidewalks. Seminole Heights, lots of neighbors. How do you afford to do all that? How do you afford, if you're going to begin to add sidewalks to those neighborhoods? We grew up as a kind of a car community, and now people are beginning to walk again. Yeah. But how do you, where do you come up with the money?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The offered transportation dollars will afford us to be able to have a complete type of sidewalk network. That's what we need. And, you know, my mother's house where I grew up, actually she bought it the year I was born, my father and her, and we still have open ditches along our street. And that is something that happens
quite a bit. That's in
West Tampa. West Tampa specifically, but it is in a lot of different places all over the city.
Yeah, you do see it all over the city. Will the transportation tax help that problem, too?
We probably would tap into our assessment for our flood waters, which we passed a couple years ago. That, I think, would be the best place to start that. But then the sidewalks on top of it, we could use dollars from All for Transportation to pay for those, too. I really believe that if you have... the first means of transportation, which are your legs. If you're able to be ambulatory and you can go from your house to a bus stop or your house to a park down the street, that's the most important type of transportation we can provide and the cheapest means of doing it.
We're talking with Mike Suarez, who's one of the candidates for Tampa mayor. The election is March 5th. Mike is a veteran Tampa City Council member, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. Okay, transportation, a lot of people ask me this. Do you want a train? Should there be a train system in the city of Tampa?
I'm a big believer in the way that we look at transportation is more holistic. Picking a technology doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I have no problem with providing a train if that makes sense. For the last 2.5 years, I've been using a tagline on my Twitter and some other places, which is transportation or transit is freedom. We need that kind of freedom so people that are in different parts of the city and different parts of the county have an ability to live where they want, live in a house that they have picked or an apartment or a condo, and be able to travel using different means of transportation. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to ride the bus. That doesn't mean everyone's going to have a car. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to use Uber or Lyft or ride a bike. But we need to have room for all those types of transportation options to make us a more vibrant community. One of the things that I have, if you talked to me in 2011 whether or not we needed to have a train, I probably would have a different answer for you. But technology has outstripped our ability to kind of keep track, excuse the pun, on what we're able to do. I would love for us to do more transit-oriented development, which we don't do. And what that means is the city or HART or any other governmental entity owns a piece of property, they lease that to a builder or a developer. They build it up. We have a mixed use in the bottom floor. We also have parking that might be available that has use for those riders that want to ride on the bus. And then the money that we receive from the developer for the lease goes right back into operating funds for it. For us, I think the first thing we're going to do when I'm mayor is complete the extension of the streetcar from where it's at up to Tampa Heights. That's our first goal.
Is there enough ridership on the streetcar, do you think?
The streetcar, after we made it free, has spiked to about 2,000% increase. Now, that does not mean that it is at maximum efficiency. One of the things that we don't have is a modern streetcar, meaning, air-conditioned and, really sleek vehicles that we can do. We need to do that also. But in addition, we would not have the kind of development in Channelside had the streetcar not been built. We wouldn't have the kind of vibrancy in parts of Ybor City without the streetcar being built. That doesn't mean everyone in those areas uses a streetcar. It means that developers recognize that this place is going to be a destination and it's got the kind of transit that we need in order to go forward. Extending it only makes it even more attractive.
At last night's forum, there was a discussion about the city of Tampa being in debt to the tune of about, I believe the number is $13 million. Is that right?
It is $14.6 million. On a yearly basis for the next five fiscal years.
That's what you have to service every year.
So that's a huge amount.
Where did that debt come from?
Here's the most frustrating thing. Probably about 3 years ago when we started to talk about this, and we talked about it in earnest, it did not come up for us on council during the 2011 race. But what we knew that there was some debt out there. We didn't know that it was non-convertible, meaning that we couldn't refinance. Just like any other kind of debt, typically bonds can be refinanced. That was a bond that could not be refinanced. They never put any money into the debt itself. They never paid any principal or interest. We could not convert it, meaning that we couldn't change it into something else. And then we had to pay for it. That went into, that was a line that they borrowed in order to buy the current police station in downtown Tampa.
Oh, okay. All
because
right.
if you remember, the old police station where Stetson University is located was dilapidated. It needed to be refurbished. They bought the building and for probably about, if I'm not mistaken, about $7 million, and they put more dollars into it. So probably a $20 million ask. The worst part about this is that that was 2 months prior to the community investment tax being passed.
Mm.
And what frustrates me is that they had a very short discussion about it. I've looked at the tapes. There are some people that are still in government that were on that board. And there were two people that I admire greatly, Rudy Fernandez, who was on the board, and my old professor, Scott Payne. Both of them voted against it. And they voted against it, and Scott said it best. If you are going to make a commitment to the public that you're going to do something, you should tell them how we're going to do it and why we need to do it. This, and at that time, that particular bond issue didn't meet that criteria. And I agree with them. Had they waited 2 more months, we could have wrapped it into our community investment tax. We could have done more with what we had, but instead now we're stuck with this debt.
All right, so does that $14 million, does that present a problem for the next 5 years for the city budget? And if so, if it presents a problem, how would you solve it?
It presents a challenge. Let me put it that way. Now, here's the good news, okay? The good news is not the debt. The good news is that Amendment 1 did not pass, which would have had another exemption on property taxes, and we would have lost about $6 million this coming year, maybe a little bit more. So now we don't have that $6 million in the hole that we were going to look at. So instead of it being a $14.6 million hit, it's probably about $8.6 million. And depending on how much we've gotten in terms of tax revenues, and, you know, property values are going up, we're probably going to have even less than 8.6. So it doesn't present the kind of problem that we were expecting. One of the reasons why when the mayor had suggested a couple years ago to raise the millage rate, I was against it only because we could find about $4 million in cuts and prepare ourselves in the next year for the next fiscal, problem. It is going to be a problem every year. If we hit a recession, it's going to be a significant problem. If we don't and things keep going, I think we'll be able to handle it.
Mike Suarez is one of the candidates for mayor. He's going to be on the ballot in the city of Tampa on March 5th, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. If you've got a question, you can send it in via email to us here, dj@wmnf.org. Just philosophically speaking, well, let me ask you, the Rays have said, look, we didn't get enough money, local money, from either the government or from local businesses.
Sure.
So we're pulling out of this idea of moving to Ybor City. What are your thoughts about should there be a public subsidy for private stadiums, private sports stadiums?
No, but let me put a caveat to that. Any business that comes in, there are lots of different mechanisms that we use in order to bring them in. There are incentives that are part of, the tax incremental financing, which is what our community redevelopment area is used for. Jeff Vinnick has taken advantage of that in a good way, which is he's putting in sewer lines, water lines, sidewalks, all these other things that we reimburse them using dollars that could only be used in that area. That's perfectly fine for me. If the baseball team comes to an area like that and they ask for it just like any other business, not because it's baseball, we would have to look at it and say, sure, that sounds like a good idea. But any kind of general revenue, any kind of money that can come directly out of our funds, I am not in favor of that. And I don't think that we're going to see that kind of ask. I think that the Rays will come to Tampa eventually because they know that the potential here is much greater. They're not going to leave this area. And I say this to you because, you're in radio and TV. The market here is much bigger. We're one of the top 10 markets for local viewing of the baseball team. And we have a pretty good team. And they've done a great job of actually making them winners when they're in the toughest division in baseball. So I think they're going to still stay in this area. I don't think St. Pete. I think St. Pete is definitely looking at redeveloping the Trop site. So they're going to have to find some place to go.
Is Ybor City the right place for a baseball stadium, given, that is a traffic bottleneck at 5 o'clock in the afternoon? That's one of the worst traffic areas in town, with I-4 being jammed.
You know, I... I have, you know, I love Ybor City, and I love the fact that they would want to be in Ybor City. I did not like the site only because of the sight lines with the elevated, road on the Expressway Authority right there. I didn't think it looked as good as it could in, let's say, in the middle of Vinix Project, where they just happened to buy the old flour mill, 7 acres that they could use very easily. And I don't know why Vinix and Sternberg do not come together and come up with a way of solving that problem. I think that would be a great location. And I've mentioned that to them many, many times. Neither one of them, I have no sway with them, so they have not answered my call for that.
Some cities around the state have increased the minimum wage, or at least tried to increase the minimum wage. I think the state government has prevented that, and I should know the details better. But in places like Seattle and around the country, they've raised the minimum wage above the state standard,
right,
in order to help protect the workers in that community. What do you think about raising the minimum wage? Is it possible, given our state legislature? Should we have a higher minimum wage in the city of Tampa?
I think there should be a higher minimum wage in the state of Florida, period. One of the problems we have is that we're exempted from doing that kind of work. If you recall, during the last gubernatorial election, Philip Levine had made had gone after the state in terms of having not raised the minimum wage, even though it's in the Constitution that's supposed to be raised. You notice that this past January, the minimum wage went up. Now, it's nowhere near where it needs to be in order for a working family to be able to afford, you know, the housing and transportation and food and everything else that we need. But I don't know how we do that. I think that his attack on it, based on the constitutional amendment, was a clever way of doing it, but it didn't get anywhere. There may be some legal means that we might be able to use. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not sure where we could go. But I do think that there may be a coordinated effort among cities across the state that we could probably push and make it seamless, so that one city isn't raising a minimum wage, that all of us raise at the same time. I think if you do it that way, you have a better shot of convincing the legislature to allow us to go ahead and do that. And depends on how this legislature, you never know, because they're brand new governor. I can't say what they're going to do next, but I don't think it's going to be any different than the last 8 years of Republican rule.
One of the problems that we have in Tampa is that workforce housing and housing for low-income people is disappearing in the center part of the city. A lot of low-income and moderate-income people are no longer able to live in places like Hyde Park or Palmacia, Virginia Park. Those areas are all outpriced, and a lot of poor people are moving north and to the east, sometimes out of the city. What do you do about affordable housing in the city of Tampa?
This is an issue that's the same across the country. We're lucky because we have more land. So if you look at what's going on in San Francisco, they have a very small city geographically, and they are incredible numbers of millionaires and some billionaires that are moving in that are squeezing everyone out. And that's been something that's going on for many, many years. I think that what we need to do is, whenever we have land available that is owned by the city, that we have a land bank, and then when we work with developers, we keep the land, because part of the problem is the price of land, not the building of the building itself. So as an example, I live in Riverside Heights. Somebody built a home over there, and it was $500,000. Now, I want to point out, Riverside Heights is nowhere near a kind of, you know, Tony type of place. Nothing wrong with that. I love my neighborhood, but it is not a South Tampa or some of the more, prestigious places in which there's a lot of money. And that place went for $500,000, and I was very shocked by that, because I thought, you know, here I am. I'm pretty much a middle-class guy. My wife and I both work. We have 3 kids. There's no way anybody, including myself, could afford a $500,000 house in my neighborhood. And I don't understand why we don't try and put these type of mechanisms together to make sure that the land price is reduced. Some of the things that we've talked about are tiny homes and container homes. Those are great, but the land cost is still there. So even if you have a tiny home or you have a container home, the land underneath you is still going to be incredibly expensive. So you might have a $50,000 built home on a piece of property that might be worth $150,000 or $200,000. That doesn't make any sense to me. We need to figure out how we reduce that land cost.
And how would you do it? How would you reduce the land cost?
Well, I think that when you own the land itself, the city, yeah, then you would work with a developer and say, listen, we will let you build these homes here. You can sell the home. Mm-hmm. Now, but the cost of the land is not included in the price. So if you wanted to buy that house, that might, in the open market, be $280,000. Now, if the property cost is removed from that, maybe it's $80,000 lot. I don't know. We're coming up. Or maybe it's $100,000. Now it's a lot less. You know, you've reduced that cost by $100,000. That, I think, will make it more affordable for people to stay in the city. And we need people to stay in the city of all demographics and all economic levels, because we can't survive as a city if we become a San Francisco, because we do not have the kind of tax base that they do.
We're talking with Tampa City Councilman Mike Suarez, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Last week, during the televised debate on Bay News 9, there was a dust-up involving Chief Jane Castor, and people were complaining about the Biking While Black episode. She has apologized for that, but you got into a discussion with her about whether or not the Tampa Police Department required bicyclists, mainly African-American bicyclists, to prove ownership of their bicycle. And she kind of denied that that was ever part of what TPD did. Just give us your explanation. What went on, and why did you bring it up during the debate last week?
Well, there are two different things to look at when you're talking about Bicycling While Black. I think that when you're looking to find criminals who are committing crimes on bicycles, when you look at what the proximate cause is, meaning that you get a report, a man has left the scene of a crime or a break-in, and he was on a bike, and you stop someone on a bike, that's a legitimate stop. When you're stopping someone on a bike because they say they don't have a light on their bike, I want to tell you, having lived here all my life, no one's ever stopped me for not having a light on my bike. Now, it's okay to have that rule. They're giving out the bike lights. That's great. Except that when they would stop people, they would say, is this your bike? Yes, sir, it's my bike. Here's a receipt to show that this is your bike, and we're going to write down, you know, that this is your bike. That smells of the worst kind of, you know, tactics to use with folks. And I told them, and I actually, the time that she was still chief, I questioned her about it on when I was on council, specifically to that. That's a ridiculous standard to meet, because I think it puts the police officers in a bad position. It puts the person that has been stopped in a bad position. And unfortunately, I don't think that that message has gotten through. When I'm mayor, we're going to change that, and we're going to open it up to the community and say, anyone that has a bike, that owns a bike, and you want it to be registered, as we used to do back in the old days, come on in. We'll register your bike to make sure that if someone steals your bike, we'll be able to identify it and find it for you. I have no problem with that. That is proactive, and that's pro-community. That is not about stopping people just because, you know, they happen to look a certain way or they're in a certain neighborhood or anything else. That's the wrong way, in my mind, to police.
I just want to make it clear. Was TPD stopping people to on the suspicion that they didn't own the bike that they were riding?
They were stopping people, as I recall, and I'll have to go back and look at the report on this. They were stopping them because they didn't have a bike light.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was a predicate to then ask them that question. To me, I understand that you want to say, hey, be safe, here's a bike light. If you stop and say, hey, look, here's a bike light for you, you know, that can be a very innocuous kind of stop. But I do believe that saying, here's a bike light, by the way, do you own this bike? Show me what, you know, do you have anything to show that? Well, look, I'm going to give you a piece of paper, make sure you carry it with you. That is not what we're about here in this country.
That's going too far, you're saying.
I believe so. Yeah. I believe so.
We're talking with Mike Suarez, who's running for mayor of Tampa. This is WMNF 88.5 FM. You know, I know you know this, that people, especially in places like East Tampa and parts of West Tampa, low-income communities like Sulphur Springs, one is they want to be safe in their apartment or their house, and they want, when something goes wrong, they want the TPD to act effectively.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, they don't want to be over-policed. They, you know, they don't want the Tampa Police Department to act like a military squad going into their neighborhood. How would you balance that?
Well, you know, I'll give you a couple of situations that's happened while I've been on council. There's a neighborhood leader that's in the East Tampa area. She complained about a police officer that was not very kind to her and didn't communicate to her in a way that she felt that she deserved, because she's a neighborhood leader. She's there to help all the other neighbors and to communicate to police. we got involved. We made sure that we kind of connected the police department and his, his superior to say, look, this guy's got to have a little bit of a different attitude in order to go forward. We had the same situation where I work out at the Y over on Palm Avenue. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there is a group of African American men, older, probably in their 60s, that work out in the morning. I know them all, and one of them came up to me during the time that we were working out together, and he said, "You know, we were outside waiting for the Y to open, which is opens at 5:30 in the morning." And a police officer, a new police officer, came up to us who didn't know us and was, he didn't say harass them, but he said, you know, they were bothering us and said, well, we're waiting for the Y to open up. And there's about four African-American males there. The man that was telling me about this is a former parole officer. He's a guy that knows law enforcement. So we had to get involved. We got involved with the superiors and say, listen, this is why you need to make sure we don't do this. So we set it up so that they did a roll call in the area, make sure that everyone knows the police officers are there. That's what positive community policing is all about. That's what we have to do more of. It's not that we're not doing it now. We're doing a lot of that. And I think that Chief Dugan has, you know, tried his best to do that. I think that we just need to keep emphasizing that and keep going with it. Because right now, when we don't want to escalate issues when somebody is aggrieved, and we don't want police officers to feel like, you know, we're not protecting them. We want everyone to be protected, and we want police officers to know that the community has your back, because you're out there and you've got their back, and you're making sure that you're positive, you're presenting yourself in a better way towards the community. That's what's important.
Mike, I've been asking this of the last few candidates. Do you have a politician, either a contemporary politician or a politician in history, that you look up to and admire?
Wow, you've asked quite an interesting question, because I've known a few myself. I worked for Bob Graham, you just mentioned. And I have to say that Bob Graham, because of the close working relationship we had, because of the way that he presented himself, because of the way that he got out there and did his work days. Now, here's a guy that's a U.S. senator, came from a wealthy family in South Florida. He started these work days, and there's a local reporter by the name of Al Rochelle. Al had a conversation with me talking about Tom Harkin, who used to do work days too. Well, Tom Harkin used to go and milk the cow at the 5 o'clock hour or 5:15 or 5:30.
U.S. Senator from Iowa.
Senator from Iowa. And then as soon as the cameras and the radio guys were gone, Tom Harkin wiped his hands and left. Bob Graham did it differently. He started when they told him that he had to start, and he stayed there all day. And I used to love when reporters used to show up in the middle of the day thinking that he was gone, and sure enough, there's Bob Graham still working hard. And, you know, that really changed the way that people felt about him personally and the way that they thought about the when he was governor and then when he was senator. He was trying to connect to people all the time. That's the kind of mayor I want to be, and that kind of example is what drives me.
If you were elected mayor and you wanted to be known for one thing, to have accomplished one thing in the next 4 years, what would that be?
That's a good question. I think that for me is to keep our economy more thriving, make sure that people understand that it's about our neighborhoods. My tagline in my campaign is every neighborhood is Tampa. There's a reason why. It's because we were just talking about what East Tampa wants. East Tampa wants the same thing that every other part of this city wants. You know, they want those four tenants, those neighborhood bill of rights. They want to make sure that we're providing the kind of public safety that they need, the kind of transportation and sidewalks and other services they need. They want to make sure that the good water comes in, the bad water goes out, the trash is picked up, and the potholes are filled. And the third thing is they want to have integrity in government. They want to make sure that the things that we say we're going to do, we're going to do. That's one of the reasons why the neighborhood bill of rights, to me, is a great way of presenting it. It will be on my wall in my office. It will be there in every one of the senior staff members' offices to make sure that they're living up to the commitments that we keep making each and every day.
And one last question, global warming, how big of an impact, how much should the next mayor consider the impact of global warming on the city of Tampa?
I think that it's an important thing that's happening right now. I think that we can make some positive changes. One of the things that I'd like to do is reduce the amount of fleet vehicles that we have and have vehicles that are more, either CNG or electric. because electric has its own problems because we got a coal burning plant right now. And I would love for us to see how we do that, negotiate with TECO to reduce the kind of electricity, light bulbs that we're able to use. Because, you know, that's all through the Public Service Commission. We don't have control over that. But I think that we need to continually look at ways to make us more resilient to climate change and to change the way that we do things. I know that the folks from Sierra Club came to me probably about 2 years ago to talk about the climate challenge. I have no problem with that, but I do think that we need to look at the things that we can do in the city of Tampa legally that change that. And that means reducing our fleets, making sure that we can reduce our carbon footprint. You know, we do have a someone that's a green officer there, and we will emphasize that when I'm mayor.
Mike Suarez, thanks a lot for coming by. Good
My
to
pleasure.
See you. What's the website for the campaign?
The website is mikefortampa.com. I'm on Twitter at @MikeForTampa. Please follow me if you want. I'm on Facebook, which is at Mike Suarez for Tampa's mayor. I hope that you will check it out. Give me a call. My number is 813-489-9415. And we're always ready to take a call. Now, that phone call goes directly to me, and I hope that you'll call me and can contact me if you've got any questions.
All right. Mike Suarez, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Rob.
The election is March 5th for Tampa Mayor. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. From Oliver Mitakudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to open up the phones and take your phone calls, and we can talk about the Tampa mayor's race. There's another forum tonight. The Downtown Partnership in Tampa is sponsoring a forum where all the candidates have been invited to attend. We'll see what's going on with that. We'll see what happens tonight. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. I'm going to just mention this story, which I think is significant. There is the ongoing government shutdown. We've been hearing a lot about it. But here's something that came up within the last 24 hours or so. And I'm reading from The Hill, their website. This is what they say. The headline is Air Traffic Controllers Union: Flying is less safe today than it was a month ago. A top member of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association said today that flying is less safe than it was a month ago due to the partial government shutdown. Trish Gilbert was on CNN this morning. She would say, I would say flying is less safe today. Let's listen to her interview right now. And then I want to ask you whether or not you've been affected by the government shutdown.
Bottom line, would you say, Trish, that flying is less safe today than it was a month ago?
I would say it is less safe today than it was a month ago. Absolutely. We do not have the professionals on the job. We are working with bare bones crews. We have controllers there doing what they do very, very well. But how long can you expect them to do it without all of the systems behind them to keep the system safe and the planes in the air? It's not just the air carriers that we're working through the system. It's life flights with organs. It's packages with cargo flights. Mm-hmm. It's the military. All of this is very important to this country. It's an economic engine, the air traffic control system in this country. And right now, you're putting this incredible strain on the system, which is unacceptable and unreasonable. This is a horrible game of chicken that we're in the middle of, and we need to get out of it, and we need to get out of it today.
Goodness. An air traffic controller tweeted his concerns specifically, this was last week, about maintenance of the communication systems. He was saying that because people aren't checking out these systems, he's having trouble communicating with pilots at times, which is a remarkable thing for an air traffic controller to say. Beyond security screening on the ground, where there's been a lot of focus, TSA, are you concerned about issues like that?
Absolutely. We have a very robust volunteer reporting system, safety reporting system, where all of the workforce, when they're all there, they're not all there right now, are able to report safety concerns. What we can still do that today, but there's nobody underneath to take any action with the things that were reported. We have, you know, dozens of things reported every single day. So that process is completely torn away from the workforce. Maintenance of our infrastructure, new technologies that would improve safety, a piece of technology that is going to help controllers identify aircraft that are lined up on the wrong taxiway or runway, which was a critical event that we almost saw, you know, tragic event in San Francisco last year when we had the Airbus lined up on the taxiway. So all of those things are very concerning to us.
Look, I think that you said it all. When you said flying is less safe now than it was a month ago, that is something every American and every member of Congress and in the White House should be thinking a lot about. Thank you. Good luck. And thanks to all the people you represent.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was Trish Gilbert, the Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, the union that represents air traffic controllers here in the U.S. She was on CNN this morning. You can see that on the CNN website. The Washington Post reported yesterday that the Federal Aviation Administration is seeking to recall thousands of workers who had been furloughed, but who they have deemed essential to deal with safety concerns. Thousands of FAA employees are currently working without pay or have been forced to stay home. Gilbert, in that CNN interview, noted that air traffic controllers have a robust safety system in which its workforce can report all safety problems, but, she said, those who usually take action based on those reported concerns are not currently working. So, she said, there's nobody underneath to take any action with the things that are being reported. The Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, those agents have also been hit hard by the shutdown, with the agency reporting this week that more than twice the normal rate of employees have been calling in sick as the partial government shutdown leaves them working without pay. Major airports across the country have dealt with long security lines and even closures due to a lack of staffing. Federal judge yesterday refused to issue an order that would have forced the federal government to temporarily pay federal workers during the government shutdown. And the National Air Traffic Controllers Association and the National Treasury Employees Union had brought lawsuits challenging the shutdown on behalf of their members. Now, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, says because of the shutdown, she's asking President Trump to delay his scheduled State of the Union address, which I think is scheduled for 2 weeks from this past Monday. So again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And the question is, have you been affected by the government shutdown? Has this affected you in any way? If you're working for the government, has it affected you? If you use government services, has it affected you? And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. David writes this regarding the mayoral candidates. He says he would like to see Tampa police write more speeding tickets for crazy drivers. One of the worst places for speeders I've seen is on Central Avenue in Seminole Heights in Tampa. And people routinely go 50 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, even though it goes parallel to and is adjacent to a major freeway. That's David's email. And if you've got a comment about something that's in the news, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And I'm curious as to whether or not maybe you've been flying recently and you've got some experience in the airline, security screening for the airlines. If you've got some direct experience, call us up, let us know that what you've seen. And if you've got any other experience with the shutdown, let us know. The shutdown is in its 26th day. The latest caravan of Honduran migrants hoping to reach the U.S. has crossed peacefully into Guatemala under the watchful eyes of about 200 Guatemalan police and soldiers. This happened yesterday. About 500 people passed through the Agua Caliente border crossing from Honduras into Guatemala last night. The fate that awaits them, though, at the U.S.-Mexico border is uncertain. The previous caravans of refugees that were seized and pointed at by President Trump last year in the run-up to the midterm elections have quietly dwindled, with many of those people, those refugees, having gone back home to Central America or put down roots in Mexico. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can also email your comment into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. The acting Environmental Protection Agency Chief Andrew Wheeler's past lobbying work is expected to draw scrutiny as his confirmation hearing today for the permanent post. A Senate committee is considering Wheeler as President Trump's nominee for EPA Administrator. Wheeler has served as the agency's acting head since Scott Pruitt resigned in July amid allegations over Pruitt's spending and alleged favor-seeking. Environmental groups want senators to question Wheeler about his lobbying for coal interests and others just before he joined the EPA. Watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington has filed an ethics complaint alleging Wheeler improperly oversaw regulatory rollbacks benefiting coal and others that he had lobbied for. And French President Emmanuel Macron is casting doubt on chances that the European Union will negotiate Britain's exit deal after British lawmakers yesterday roundly rejected the one their government reached with the EU. Parliament voted 432 to 202 against the proposed Brexit divorce deal. Speaking in Normandy, France, after the vote, the French president said he really couldn't believe the vote because the EU went as far as it could. He told British leaders to figure it out yourselves and wished them good luck in figuring out a way to leave the EU on March 29th without a clear plan. That's the deadline set by the Brexit vote to leave for Britain to leave European Union. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. If there's a news item that you want to comment about, but I'm really curious whether or not you have been affected by the government shutdown, if you noticed anything. I've seen there have been several stories in the paper saying that federal workers need food assistance. So if you're one of those people who's been affected by the shutdown, call us up, tell us what your experience is. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is pushing for sanctions against the company Airbnb unless it reverses its decision to bar lodging listings in the occupied West Bank. The Republican governor yesterday in South Florida criticized the online lodging marketplace for a policy that he says unfairly targets Jewish people. DeSantis is suspending the use of Airbnb for any state-paid travel. DeSantis also said the state was looking into whether to bar the state's pension fund from investing in Airbnb, even though that company is not now publicly traded. Airbnb announced in November that it would cease its operations in Israeli settlements that are at the core of the dispute between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So, an Airbnb spokesperson says that Airbnb does do business in Israel, not in the occupied territories. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And if there's a news item that you want to mention, that you want to talk about, let's get that conversation going. Usually the first people to call in are the ones that steer the conversation. And you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Thanks to Bill Grace. He's our phone producer today. And we've got some phones ringing. Let's see who's calling in. Hey, caller, you're on MNF. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Carl from Clearwater.
Hi, Carl. What would you like to say?
Quick comment. First, I love your show.
Thank you.
Listen all the time. But how can American employers demand that someone come to work without getting paid? It just blows my mind that they can literally demand that someone come to work at their expense and not be compensated. I don't know.
It doesn't seem fair. I mean, when I go to work, depending on what my job is, sometimes I have to have clothes that are dry cleaned. I certainly have to have, for my daily job on the radio, I've got to have gas in my car. So if I can't afford the gas, it's really hard for me to come to work because the public transportation system in Tampa is so bad. So you're right. How can they do that? And I've read, too, that the employees, if they don't show up for work, get sanctioned. They get penalized.
I believe in our past, people were required to work for no pay, and it was called slavery.
Carl, you know, you think President Trump is claiming that he's got all these government workers on his side, and he hasn't provided anybody to be interviewed. There have been a lot of interviews with government workers who are going without paying their car payment, without paying their rent because they have no money. When President Trump says that he thinks that there are government workers on his side, what do you make of that?
I think it's absurd. I mean, it is.
And do you think the president understands what it's like to live?
He's a very callous human being.
Do you think the president understands what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck?
No.
Yeah, 78%
that has no clue.
78% of the public here in the U.S. works paycheck to paycheck.
Yep, exactly. And I hope that's not lost on people. That's the world we live in now, where seven out of 10 Americans can make it about a month. It's disgusting. But I just can't believe that we live in a society where you can be required under the threat of punishment to come to work and expect no compensation.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't make any sense. That is slavery. All right, Carl, thanks for starting the conversation.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. So you heard Carl. What are your views? 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jamie, who's in Brooksville. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing a lot better than a lot of people, not quite as good as some others, put it that way. I just turned into this, and I guess the previous caller was speaking to what I want to speak to, but this whole time with all the confusion between being furloughed and being kept on necessary but not getting paid, but eventually getting paid, and furloughs never getting paid. And suddenly we have all these people, 40,000 people, that are coming back because they're considered necessary at this point, whereas they weren't before, and with no compensation coming in sight. My question is, why are all these people doing this? I mean, it's like the teacher's strike. It's like if all these people said, look, we do our job, we do it well, we're not coming in, what I'd like to know is what kind of sanctions does the government hold over them? I mean, if you're furloughed, they don't ever have to bring you back.
Yeah, I don't know what their employment agreement says, I've read over and over again that for some workers, if they don't show up for work, they get sanctions. So I'll find an article about it that explains exactly what that is.
I'm just wondering if everyone, in solidarity, like the teachers striking right now, just said, look, if we're so unnecessary that you can furlough us with no pay, then you don't need us back. And I know it sounds easy for me to say, but, there's enough people out there right now that if they just said no and called in sick, there would be a huge impact.
You're talking about a national strike.
You're
talking about a national strike by all workers, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see, Jamie. Right. That may be an idea that people want to pursue. Thanks. Chris in Tampa, though, disagrees with this. He says nobody cares that big nanny government is closed. Do you agree with Chris? Chris writes in via email saying that nobody cares that the big nanny government is closed. You know, I'm wondering, do you care whether the Coast Guard is shut down or whether planes are being inspected, whether food inspectors are showing up for work, whether or not those TSA security workers are being paid at the airport? Do you worry about that? Chris says no, he doesn't worry about it. Thanks to Bill Grace. He's our phone producer today, and you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. And let's go to Julie in Tampa. Hi, Julie.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Well, I was calling a reference to the local, which you're asking if you're hearing or seeing, but I just heard you talk about Chris. Hey, Chris, when your house burns down, I guess you don't want the firemen to come out, and we have national disasters. You don't want the government to come out and help the military and police. But, Rob, what I was calling about was I work for a local charity here in Tampa, and I have to go out and see businesses and hopefully ask them to have us help. And I was just out at a law firm, and they're bringing out 350 lunches, honey-baked hams, to the TSA. And another example of the community trying to come together under this terrible situation is in line at Trader Joe's, my friend, a perfect stranger, just told her, I have no credit cards, they're maxed out now, and I have to pay cash, and she's one of our government workers. So there's tons of stories out there. And it's too bad Trump doesn't listen to them, bring them to the microphone and let them talk. And I think he needs to take his bigly hands and get a pen and let's get this over with.
All right, Julie, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Yeah, that's got to be tough if your credit cards are maxed out. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and I was asking whether or not you've been affected by this government shutdown. And let's go to Ott in Largo. Ott, I hope I pronounced your name right.
Yes, Art from Largo.
That's right. Art. Okay, it's Art. All right. Art, what would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to talk about the governor's issue with Airbnb. Number one, he refers to the West Bank as a biblical heartland of Judea and Samaria. And these are the words that the Israeli government have been using for decades. I mean, and it is a religious term, so... I'm questioning whether he's separating religion from the secular government. Second point he made was that it was a moral obligation. Now, that's a weak argument to say it's a moral obligation. What is that, the attitude that he has towards Airbnb? Because the government's morality approves Israeli illegal settlements in Palestinian disputed lands. And the third point I want to make is that there is no dispute, he said, over Israel's right to settle the West Bank. Well, he apparently doesn't realize that the West Bank and Gaza are occupied territories that are supposed to be the future future lands of the future Israeli Palestinian government. I mean... I just don't understand his reasoning at all.
Yeah, and most of the world, including the United Nations, says that that occupation is illegal.
That's true. Yeah. Very true.
All right. Art, thanks a lot. Thanks for your views. All right. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Nancy, who's on the road. Nancy, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
So when I worked for the government years ago, you had to sign a document that said that you would not strike, and not showing up is essentially striking. And if you do, then you're subject to being fired. So that's basically what happened to the air traffic controllers back in the day with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, when Ronald Reagan took office in 1981, yeah.
Right. So when those air traffic controllers went on strike, he fired them all. So people that work for the government are reluctant to... you know, call in sick and that kind of thing, because that puts them in a situation where, hey, when this thing gets solved, am I going to have a job?
And Carl, one of our first callers, compared that to slavery. Did you feel when you were a government worker that that really took away your human rights?
You know, yes and no. You know, it's a trade-off. You get, when you work for the government, there's benefits you get, and it's very uncomfortable to sign a document like that that says you won't strike, that you won't, you know, they're kind of taking those rights away from you. But, you know, you make that choice. I'm not saying it's a good thing that they do this, but neither can I say that I feel like a slave. Because, yeah, I made the choice to sign the document.
Yeah. We got an email on this, and I'll just read it to you, Nancy, and read it to everybody. Jonathan writes, since the enactment of the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, federal employees have been legally prohibited from striking. That law was intended to prevent public sector workers from leveraging a work stoppage that could cripple the U.S. government or major industries in negotiations for better pay, working conditions, and benefits. But it likely did not envision a scenario where the government would require its employees to work without paying them, as is the case now. That's Jonathan's email.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
All right, Nancy.
So that kind of answers your question about what kind of sanctions. That's the sanction.
Yeah. All right, Nancy, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. We're out of time, but if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. You can comment about today's show on extension 115. And when you record that comment on extension 115, I'll play it back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. We'll have another candidate's interview tomorrow. Former Police Chief Jane Castor is scheduled to be on tomorrow at 11. Stay tuned for NOLA next on Midpoint. This is WMNF 10.